Doesn't every child learn to love country, pledging allegiance in school, hearing the glorious stories of men and women and righteous wars, and family times together on national holidays? When is it that cracks appear in one's simplistic view of country? One marker for me took place in college in a course that I took on historiography, and I think I've mentioned that before, but let me again, because it was significant in my own history. Historiography is the study, not of history itself, but of how historians write history. I learned that the history we read in books is never just the facts. Each historian has a point of view, and from that point of view, facts are selected, arranged, and then woven in a narrative. In class, we examined how American historians had different views on the Pilgrims, views that at some points are in sharp contrast to the usual stories that we hear at Thanksgiving time. Then that glorious winning of the West under the banner of Manifest Destiny turned out to have an incredible amount of blood and betrayal. One view of America that has for me crumbled in more recent years is the idea that this country is a credible democracy. That's not an easy thing to say, for deeply ingrained in our history is President Wilson's World War I banner, making the world safe for democracy. And in the Second World War, one slogan used by President Franklin D. Roosevelt was to call this country the arsenal of democracy. So ingrained is democracy in the American consciousness that the two words, America and democracy, can be used interchangeably. In contrast to that, what impresses itself on my mind and my emotions as well is that there is a huge, ugly denial of the democratic process of voting for 237 years that has moved me from 3 to 2 cheers for American democracy. Although aware of this for decades, it was only in the recent 4-week class that I was teaching in a large Methodist church in Houston that the full enormity of what had taken place overwhelmed me. The overall topic for those 4 weeks was the 1960s, and one Sunday was on race and segregation. I begin here now a 4-part story in this talk. Part one took place in 1788. New Hampshire became the 9th and the final state to ratify the Constitution. As honored by the Constitution is, it contains at least one major flaw in the very first article, a flaw that led to the death of almost 620,000 men only 72 years later. The promise contained in the Declaration of Independence 12 years earlier was that all men are created equal. However, that was squashed when it came to slaves. And as importantly, each slave had the status for population count and taxation purposes of 3/5 of a person. Part two. The fruits of that compromise erupted in the Civil War 72 years later. 5 years after the war was over, the 15th Amendment to the Constitution was ratified and prohibited the federal and state governments from denying a citizen the right to vote based on that citizen's race, quote, race, color, or previous condition of servitude, unquote. Well, that might seem to have closed the matter, at least of voting for blacks. It only took a five-year war with 620,000 men killed and the amending of the Constitution. But no, that did not happen. For almost 100 years, the results of the war and the 15th Amendment crumbled under the Jim Crow laws in the South. Legally, blacks could vote, but they did not. Why? Intimidation. Pure and simple intimidation. Intimidation by lynching and the daily grinding processes of Jim Crow. It was a vicious, ugly, and bloody period in American history. Mitch Landrieu, the mayor of New Orleans, gave a speech just in May of this year, very recently, on the removal of Confederate monuments in New Orleans. And of course, the big one was the removal of Robert E. Lee. And he said these words: America was the place where nearly 4,000 of our fellow citizens were lynched, 540 alone in Louisiana, where the courts enshrined separate but equal, where freedom riders coming to New Orleans were beaten to a bloody pulp. So when people say to me that the monuments in question are history, well, what I have just described is real history as well, and it is the searing truth. And it immediately begs the questions: why are there no slave ship monuments, no prominent markers on public land to remember the lynchings or the slave blocks? Nothing to remember this long chapter in our lives, the pain, the sacrifice, the shame. All of it happening on the soil of New Orleans. So for those self-appointed defenders of history and the monuments, they are eerily silent on what amounts to this historical malfeasance, a lie by omissions. There's a difference between remembrance of history and reverence of it. And so what did blacks learn during these 90 years of intimidation? You keep your head down, don't get noticed, be subservient. And let's not sanitize these lynchings. I'm going to read an account of a lynching that took place at probably around 1910 in Vicksburg, Mississippi, and it was the and this is an account in their newspaper, and I'm taking it from a book called Without Sanctuary, nice thick book, Lynching Photography in America. The newspaper writes about the killing of a husband and wife. Increasingly familiar ritual of torture, mutilation, and murder. When the two Negroes were captured, they were tied to trees, and while the funeral pyres were being prepared, and lynchings weren't just by rope, it was also by fire. When the funeral pyres were being prepared, they were forced to hold out their hands while one finger at a time was chopped off. The fingers were distributed as souvenirs. The ears of their murderers were cut off. The husband was beaten severely. His skull was fractured and one of his eyes knocked out with a stick hung by a shred from the socket. The most excruciating form of punishment consisted in the use of large corkscrew in the hands of some of the mob. The instrument was bored into the flesh of the man and the woman in the arms, legs, and body, and then pulled out, the spirals tearing out big pieces of raw, quivering flesh every time it was withdrawn. and then they were burned alive. And this is one of the 4,000 lynchings that Mayor Landrieu was referring to. In my research on this talk, I also encountered a song sang by Billie Holiday. I don't know if you're familiar with that. I had heard about it a long time ago, but it prompted me to go to the internet and look it up and listen to it, called Strange Fruit. Yeah. Billie Holiday was born in 1915 and died in 1959. It's a very plaintive song. So apparently a number of you have heard the song. You're further ahead than I was. Southern trees bear strange fruit, blood on the leaves and blood at the root, black bodies swinging in the southern sphere, southern breeze, strange fruit hanging from the poplar trees. Pastoral scenes of the gallant south, the bulging eyes and the twisted mouth, scent of magnolias, sweet and fresh, then the sudden smell of burning flesh. Here is the fruit for the crows to pluck, for the rain to gather, for the wind to suck, for the sun to rot, for the trees to drop. Here is a strange and bitter crop. I don't remember my school books ever talking about this part of American history. It disappeared. So why are we still fighting after the carnage of the Civil War and the 15th Amendment to the Constitution? It was intimidation. And you can imagine that even if you were in a small community in this area of blacks, would you not hear about some of the lynchings that took place over in Florida? Part three of this talk. When servicemen began returning from World War II, having fought to make the world safe from tyranny and for democracy, returning and being immersed in the old Jim Crow society, it was intolerable. The 1960s civil rights movement was, in my opinion, our second civil war. Two main issues addressed by the Southern civil rights movement of the 1960s were the ending of Jim Crow and winning the right to vote. There seemed to be at that time an explosion of direct action in the civil rights movement. Sit-ins, freedom rides, marches, boycotts all took place. Resistance to black voter registration and defense of segregation by the KKK and the white citizens' councils was ruthless. And the entire range of law enforcement, from the local police officer on the beat to FBI headquarters in Washington, mobilized itself to defend the established order. You need only go back to look at what J. Edgar Hoover was doing and saying back in those days. We all know of Selma. What is lost is the movement exploding in other places: Albany, Americus, Birmingham, Bugalasa, once known as Klan Town, USA. Something I did not know. Cambridge, Canton, Chapel Hill, Charlotte, Danville, Gladstone, Gainesville, Greensboro, Hattiesburg, Jackson, Macomb, Monroe, Montgomery, Nashville, New Orleans, Rock Hill, Ruleville, St. Augustine, Selma, Shreveport, Tallahassee. And then, of course, there were smaller communities as well. And then, of course, there was Selma. And the prominence of Selma tends to blot out all these other places where confrontations were taking place. Selma had Bloody Sunday on March 7th of 1965. And then 3 days later, there was another march. And that's when James Reb got killed, the Unitarian Universalist minister, and two others who were traveling in a car with him. And there was a third march in Selma on March 25th. And this was protected by President Johnson's federalizing 1900 Alabama National Guard. The result of all of this activity throughout the South was that tens of thousands of would-be voters are fired or evicted. Entire tent cities had to be set up to house sharecroppers thrown off their land for trying to register to vote. Hundreds and then thousands of protesters are jailed. Many, the actual number has never been counted, are murdered. However, there was something different about the 1960s. Instead of being intimidated, the movement soldiered on. And someone said, "We bury our dead and weep for our wounded, but we don't turn back." So something had changed. And in that period of time, we got the Voting Rights Act. Why are we talking about voting rights in 1965, when we fought a civil war, when we had an amendment to the Constitution? It took 57 days of floor fights and mass protest in Washington, D.C. To overcome the filibuster. So when we think today that there's a dysfunction in Congress, or at least in the Senate, you can think of it going on for 57 days, almost 2 months. And among the provisions of the Voting Rights Act is that it outlaws phony voting requirements such as literacy tests. Lyndon Johnson said at that time, "There can be no one too poor to vote." And when the 24th Amendment was passed, Texas was one of five southern states that still had poll taxes. Part 4. In the news these days, we find that there are still efforts to deny votes. The president has set up a new commission to root out across the country voting irregularities. But we know what it's for, because there seem to be at least a few irregularities, but there are a lot of people who are voting that the Republicans don't want to vote. Now, this is not an anti-Republican sermon, because most of the time, the fight against allowing blacks to vote and others was by the Democrats, and now it's the Republican Party. There's an attempt by voter ID laws, there are voter purges, and there's deceit. That is giving out false information at the time of elections, that voting places have changed and so forth. One new piece of information that has recently come to light is a comment by Richard Nixon's domestic policy chief, John Ehrlichman. He was also part of the Watergate scandal, so his name became very prominent. He told Harper's writer Dan Baum that the war on drugs was created as a political tool to fight back blacks and hippies. And these are a quote from him. "The Nixon campaign in 1968 and the Nixon White House after that had two enemies, the anti-war left, and black people. You understand what I'm saying? We knew we couldn't make it illegal to be either against the war or black. But by getting the public to associate the hippies with marijuana and the blacks with heroin, and then criminalizing both heavily, we could destroy those communities. We could arrest their leaders, raid their homes, break up their meetings, and vilify them right night after night on the evening news. Did we know we were lying about the war on drugs? Of course we did. Ehrlichman's comment is the first time the war on drugs has been plainly characterized as a political assault designed to help Nixon win and keep the White House. It's a stark departure from Nixon's public explanations for his first piece of legislation in the war on drugs. And this was a message delivered to Congress in 1969, which framed it as a response to an increase in heroin addiction and the rising use of marijuana and hallucinogens by students. And then there was also the silent majority, the focus. But again, we know what was happening there. Well, what is the consequence of the war on drugs? In many states, once you're a convicted felon, you lose the right to vote. 1.4 million black men, 13% of adult African American males, are denied the right to vote because they serve time in prison. So Nixon's effort was successful. From 1980 to 2000, the number of prisoners in this country increased by more than 300%, while the population increased 24%. And despite having served their sentences and paid their penalties, many states disenfranchised ex-prisoners after their release. And so as a result, 2.5% of voting Texans cannot vote. That's white and black, because of prior time in prison. The disenfranchisement in Florida is at 10.4%, Mississippi 9.6%, so Texas comes out a little better than that. I titled this talk, Two Cheers for American Democracy. When I look at the history, the deliberate history of voter suppression in this country, I cannot give three cheers. Voting is a key part of democracy, and the systematic, cultural, and centuries-long denial of voting to the black population of this country is tragic and shameful. And perhaps because I lived in another country for 5 years, I do appreciate many aspects of this country that I think a lot of people do not. But at the same time, I cannot cover over this tragic part of American history. I'm very glad to be an American, and I would not particularly want to live in another country. But at the same time, I cannot, in my own mind, cover over this really dark spot in American history. Well, where do we go from here? The former President George Herbert Walker Bush spoke in 1916 at the opening of a new museum on the Washington, D.C. Mall. It was a museum dedicated to African-American history. And he said, "A great nation does not hide its history. It faces its flaws and corrects them." Are we willing to do that? If not, then I think we need to read another president as find out what our history, coming history, will be. Abraham Lincoln, in his second inaugural address, said, "Yet if God wills that it continue, the war continue, until all the wealth piled up by the bondsmen 250 years of unrequited toil shall be sunk, and until every drop of blood drawn with the lash shall be paid by another drawn with the sword. As was said 3,000 years ago, so it must be still said, the judgments of the Lord are true and righteous altogether." Well, if we don't face what our history has been and repent of that, then Lincoln may be right. And that means that we will have the crushing burden of what has happened in race until the year 2114.